I'm Jim Falzerano, and this is the Guardian Weekly podcast for November 19th, 2008. This week,
the initial jubilation of Obama's arrival could dissipate fairly quickly just in terms of the realpolitik that each country, including the U.S. and Latin American countries, have to pursue their own interests.
Latin America reacts to the prospect of Obama. A world vigilante must get out of Iraq by 2011.
Lord Bingham, who was until very recently the senior judge in Britain, he basically said that the invasion of Iraq was a serious violation of international law and indeed of the very rule of law itself.
And the Guardian's Katine project is 1 year old. Only a few weeks ago, the leaders of Latin America were eager to demonize George Bush's America and preach the socialist revolution. But now, with a black man set to occupy the White House and the U.S. economy reeling from the excesses of capitalism, how will leaders like Hugo Chavez adapt? I asked Rory Carroll, the Guardian's Latin America correspondent, what the change in mood will be south of the border.
A great sense of relief at the departure of George Bush, and a great sense of expectation over what an Obama administration will bring. And certainly the symbolic fact that there's now a non-white man who's due to step into the White House. And of course, most of Latin America are full of Latinos and also of Afro-Caribbeans. So also the issue of race is also having a great symbolic value here.
How does it affect leaders like Hugo Chavez and leaders who demonstrably ran on a socialist platform and ran against the United States in that respect?
Well, for Chavez now, it's probably he faces a dilemma because a lot of his appeal or a lot of his persona is built on opposition to gringo imperialist hegemony, as he would put it. And now with an Obama White House, and Obama, of course, has not or never supported the invasion of Iraq and was also not implicated in supporting a coup against Chavez in 2002, now Chavez's discourse will struggle to paint the White House as his agent of imperialist evil. And so Chavez is going to be in a very tricky position here. He'll have to, at least initially, which he's already done, is to try to offer a sort of olive branch and say, maybe we can improve relations with the gringos. But if Obama takes the olive branch, then things could get tricky for Chavez, because how is he then going to rally his base against a common foe? So Chavez is going to have to walk a bit of a tightrope in the next few months.
Does this mean that inevitably he's going to have to think about his domestic problems much more?
Yes, that would be, well, certainly Chavez's critics would say that what he often will do is to deflect attention from garbage that has not been collected in the streets, from horrific rates of homicide, especially in Caracas, and other issues of service delivery, that he would typically deflect attention by picking fights with leaders abroad. It could be the head of the international organizations, or it could be the American president. And so some people would think that, yes, now Chavez will be forced to focus more on domestic bread and butter issues.
What about other leaders in South America and Latin America, specifically the idea that the United States was portrayed as basically the IMF, the people are coming in trying to tell you how to run your economy and so on. Now, given the changes that the United States and other main world economies are going through, how does this affect that whole dynamic?
It's difficult for each country is going to have its own different challenges, and I think the initial jubilation of Obama's arrival could dissipate fairly quickly just in terms of the realpolitik that each country, including the U.S. and Latin American countries, have to pursue their own interests. For example, in the case of Colombia, it could actually be bad news, the arrival of Obama, because Obama has opposed a free trade deal with Colombia, citing concerns over human rights abuses by the security forces here. And that this is a free trade deal that's extremely important to certainly the political and economic elites of Colombia. So they're going to have to wrestle with that. And each country is quite different. And there's going to be a lot of huge expectations on Obama. For example, Central America and the Caribbean have been drifting into the ambit of Hugo Chavez because he's been offering very generous deals on aid and trade and discounted oil, whereas the American aid budget has shriveled under the Bush administration. So whether Obama will be able to, for example, raid his depleted treasury in Washington to try to claw back some of the influence lost to Hugo Chavez is something that we're just going to have to wait and see.
Okay, so now we have a new president coming in, Barack Obama. To what extent does he get it?
Well, he certainly talks the talk. He's been answering the signals from the past week or so that he's going to attach great importance to environmental issues and to climate change. But really, to what extent does he get it, we don't know. And certainly in the context of Latin America, there are some... It's not clear. For example, unlike John McCain, Barack Obama has actually supported maintaining tariffs against imports of Brazilian ethanol. Now, Brazilian ethanol is much more efficient, much greener than the corn-based ethanol that the American farmers produce. And so some critics could say, well, look, you know, on this particular point, and it's an important one, Obama is actually on the side of narrow U.S. economic interests, or in this case of the farmers' interests, and he's missing the bigger picture. So this is one issue to suggest that Obama is going to be, you know, he's going to be looking to shore up his own, you know, his own electorate. So I think the answer is, does he get it? We don't know yet.
As the former top British law lord branded the invasion of Iraq the work of a world vigilante, the Iraqi government has finally set a deadline for the withdrawal of all U.S. troops. The Guardian's security affairs editor, Richard Norton Taylor, reports.
Well, Lord Bingham, who was until very recently the senior judge in Britain, the presiding, the most senior judge in the House of Lords, obviously had been... concerned about the invasion of Iraq for some time, because in his first opportunity, he basically said that the invasion of Iraq was a serious violation of international law and indeed of the very rule of law itself. And he said Britain can't, and America too, of course, can't go around being the world's vigilante. Very strong stuff from a very judicious figure in one of Britain's most leading judicial authorities, really.
So obviously he'd kept this bottled up inside for quite some time.
I think so, yes. I mean, he'd... like a lot of barristers and other lawyers and academic lawyers who are freer to speak, of course, rather than judges on the bench, which he was at the time until last July, and he really lets rip.
Okay, now let's switch a little bit, because I want to ask you about the deadline that's been set by the Iraqi government, subject to their approval of Parliament, that all U.S. troops must be out of the country in 3 years.
The deal, which has been long coming, really, I mean, finally, I think it seems the Iraqi government, which is a coalition of different parties, as we know, has agreed, and it's got to go to the Iraqi Parliament now, Assembly, that all American troops would get out of main urban areas and keep their bases by the end of 2009 next year and be out of Iraq altogether by 2011. About 170,000 troops there now. This has been negotiated against the background, of course, of Barack Obama being president. Barack Obama has made it quite clear he wants to get rid of all the troops out by 2011 or thereabouts anyway, all the U.S. troops out of Iraq, certainly as quickly as possible. But there's been another sort of legal issue, really, which was the status of forces agreement, or SOFA, as they're called, whereby how liable would American troops be as they continue their military presence in Iraq. Now, there seems to be a deal at the moment whereby, it was a compromise, really, whereby if they're off duty, outside their bases, and commit serious felonies, serious crimes, then the Iraqi judicial authorities will deal with them. Otherwise, the American-owned sort of military laws will cover the actions of the American troops there.
That seemed just a few months ago. We were talking about the idea of U.S. troops leaving Iraq as being ludicrous, that the security situation was so bad, it just could not possibly happen. Now, you talked about Barack Obama being perhaps one of the instigators of this, but what does this deal tell us about the state of the Iraqi forces?
Well, I think two things. One is that the surge, that David Petraeus a couple of years ago came in and said there must be a surge. So last year, brought in a few more extra tens of thousands of American troops, pushed them in Baghdad areas where they'd been a lot of violence in the past, and that had succeeded. And also emphasis on training, your point, on training Iraqi forces, as the British have been, actually, in Basra and that area, too, where it seems to me, Touchwood, you know, Basra is now a pretty peaceful city, the second city in Iraq. And suddenly, it happened pretty suddenly after a big clampdown, really, led by the Iraqis and helped by the Americans and a bit the British earlier this year. And then suddenly there's a tipping point, really. Suddenly the Iraqis, it seems, can take control of Basra and maybe cross fingers in Baghdad and other areas as well. That's what's been hoped for, certainly with the political push, as we say, but also practically how many of tens of thousands of Iraqi forces can they cope? We should cross our fingers and see. But that's the hope. And I think if there's going to be a lot of violence when the American troops do leave, all of them, after 2011, which is, you know, a little more than 2 years. That is going to be, I suppose, a risk, but regarded now as less of a risk because I think there generally are, you know, sufficient number anyway of disciplined Iraqi forces, both the army and security forces, to keep enough, you know, sufficient law and order to do that thing on their own.
All right, final question. Do we now have a realistic prospect of an exit strategy from Iraq?
Well, we do. Certainly the British do. The Americans do first. Obama has said that all during the campaign for many, many months. He said that. That is, I want to get the guys out very, very quickly, 2011. That's what's happening now, it seems, by this deal accepted by the Iraqi government. British earlier. British gets out. British will get out, more or less, except for a couple of hundred trainees, by the middle of next year, 2009.
Richard Norton Taylor. When Barack Obama enters the White House on January 20th, he will bring the first family with him. He will bring the first puppy with him. He will bring his biography of Abraham Lincoln with him. But he won't be bringing his BlackBerry. Suzanne Goldenberg, The Guardian's Washington correspondent, told me why.
There's precedent, of course. Every communication coming out of the White House is open to public review. It enters a historical record, and presumably it can be looked at by future historians. That's something very valuable for our understanding of what happens in the White House. Previous presidents, especially, you know, George Bush, gave up email because they didn't want that blurring of lines between, you know, the personal and the official. So it was just simpler to give up on email. The other issue, of course, is hacking. You know, how do you make sure that that line of communication is secure, that it can't be hacked? So it's seen as something that it would be best to sort of act preventatively and to shut down the email.
Now, would it be fair to call Obama the first techie president?
Well, I mean, we know that George Bush used email, but no politician has made as great a use of technology and Web 2.0 technology as Obama. You know, I mean, he used text, he used Twitter, he used Facebook, he used every media available and to great effect in his organizing campaign. I think he's understood the importance of these new tools of communication far better than other candidates, and certainly better than his opponent, John McCain, you know, who never emailed and barely used a net.
So when we look at Obama in the White House, how does his superior knowledge of technology affect the way he looks at the presidency on a day-to-day basis? How will it affect the way he works, the way he structures his day? Granted, he's not going to be using his BlackBerry, but give us a sense of how, what kind of advantage that might give him.
Well, I think this is a president-elect, as he is now. This is a man who has shown that he places a great deal of importance on communication, that he knows how to communicate, both, you know, in the oldest way possible in terms of giving a great speech, but also in all the various other ways of reaching out. So we've seen him be innovative already in the weekly Democratic radio address. He's turned that into video. So it's going to be more open and accessible White House. I think it's also going to be one, according to, or it should be one, according to his promises, that puts a great deal of stock on science. You know, he's talked a lot about the importance of science, and under George Bush, you know, there was a feeling that, you know, sort of science took a backseat to politics very often, and especially in terms of climate and reproductive health. So that's going to be a big change. You're going to see transparency, a much greater effort at outreach and communication, greater emphasis on innovation and science.
One more question. His great role model, Lincoln, was a man who had to face tremendous challenges. And as you read the biographies of Lincoln, I'm thinking of the Doris Kearns Goodwin book that he is reading or has read, The Team of Rivals. You realize what a tremendous weight, what a tremendous pressure was on Lincoln, in a way, a profound loneliness that comes with responsibility. Do you think in any way that this technology is going to be able to shield Obama from this, or is that just the fate of all presidents that have to make difficult decisions?
I think loneliness is the fate of all presidents, and I think Obama is getting to grips with that now. He gave his first interview to CBS, and he talked about the loneliness of office, and he actually admitted that he sometimes felt overwhelmed by the sort of challenges that he faces in terms of a global economic crisis and two wars. In that sense, you can see why Obama would claim an affinity with Lincoln. Both of them came to power at a time of great crisis. Lincoln came to power when the Civil War was just beginning, and Obama now is inheriting two wars and this economic downturn.
Each week in Guardian Weekly, we feature a piece from one of our listeners or readers to find out what life is like in a different corner of the world. This week, in her letter from Chile, Lizak Shalit explains how you can tell it's election season. It's all in the smiles.
Just like Big Brother, the guy in the yellow jacket who hangs out on my corner has been watching my every move, and so has the woman with the frizzy hair. There was a time when their constant scrutiny would have made me nervous. After all, Chile's Orwellian nightmare lasted 17 years, ending in 1990 with the return to civilian rule under elected officials. And that's exactly what these two sets of unblinking eyes aspire to be, winners of the election for alcalde and concejal, mayor and municipal councillor. My neighborhood is wallpapered in campaign posters. They hang from trees, light posts, and bus stops. Candidates' faces have replaced shampoo and beer bottles from the billboards that block my view of the Andes, still snow-capped as Santiago inches into summer. Smiles are everywhere to be seen, except among the pedestrians trying to maneuver their way through the poster boards that have taken over the city's plazas, like giant chessmen or the ceramic soldiers of Xi'an. No, the smiles are frozen on the faces of the candidates. In the last election, one commentator likened the landscape to an advertising blitz for toothpaste. Now, with Chile's copper prices plunging, the grins are more grimace than glam. A local newspaper invited its readers to post their nominees for ugly candidate. Power to the uglies, one person wrote. Down with the butocracy. A big feature of this election campaign is what I call the name game. An astounding number of hopefuls bear the same surname as Chile's leading politicians. But don't expect to learn the names of the political parties from the campaign posters. Name recognition has completely supplanted party affiliation as an electoral ploy. Only a handful of candidates acknowledge their party backers, and most of these come from the parties that oppose the ruling Concertación, whose 18 years in power has diluted the efficacy of its endorsements. High among the ranks of the disillusioned are the youngest generation of potential voters. Many refuse to register. At my subway stop, earnest youths hand out flyers calling upon their peers to deface the forests of electoral propaganda. And don't look for meaningful or even clever slogans. This year's batch has all the substance of a summer's breeze, full of platitudes about the candidate next door being a neighbor you can trust and who will work for you. One endearing feature of voting here is that men and women go to separate polling places, a throwback perhaps to the earliest days of women's suffrage. Chile is generous about giving foreign residents, like me, the vote. So I recently joined hundreds of other women at a nearby school in marking my paper ballot and placing it in a cardboard urn, where it was later counted in full view of poll watchers. Like the rest, I cast one vote for mayor and one for councillor. But unlike my fellow voters, I cast a third vote, too, by absentee ballot in the U.S. presidential elections for Barack Obama.
The letter from Chile is featured in this week's print edition of Guardian Weekly. Also in this week's edition, Larry Elliott says the economic summit in Washington was the death knell for the G8. We have a controversial piece about the Burmese Democratic leader Aung San Suu Kyi. With the military junta in Burma looking more powerful than ever, voices are starting to be raised as to whether she can or will lead a successful resistance. And with President-elect Barack Obama settling into that role, on our comment pages, Timothy Garton Ash looks at one of the really big issues facing him, nuclear disarmament. 12 months ago, The Guardian committed to an ambitious 3-year project to help change the lives of the people of Katine in Uganda. Liz Ford, the editor of The Guardian's Katine website, talks about the progress that has been made and the challenges that remain.
Basically, the project is a partnership between The Guardian and The Observer, two NGOs, which is the African Medical and Research Foundation and Farm Africa. Barclays Bank, and 25,000 people living in the rural part of Uganda that we're focusing on. And the idea is that we're focusing on five main components: health, education, livelihoods, water and sanitation, and governance. And it's to basically improve their lives in these particular areas. It's over a period of 3 years. We've just had our first anniversary, so we've got two more to go. And the idea is that once we leave, it'll be something sustainable for them to carry on.
Okay, now let's talk about very specific things that we are doing down there. Give me two or three things that are there now that weren't there before.
Okay, the biggest single achievement is a new primary school in a village called Amorokot. And beforehand, it was a series of sort of modern wattle huts and thatch roofs where the children had their lessons, which were very susceptible to bad weather, so often falling down, so lots of hazards, as well as just not being a conducive place for education. Now there's a brand new school built, bricks and mortar, new desks, that opened in September. Since that's been open, the school enrolment rates have shot up. And the kids, somebody sort of said they've never seen children so excited about being in school because they've actually now got desks to sit at, proper classrooms, blackboards on the wall, all those kind of things.
And what else? What are the tangible results can you point to?
There's been a real problem with unsafe water in this area. So there have been wells that have been dug in the past, boreholes that have been dug that just haven't been maintained or have just not been built correctly. So what's happened is there are now 8 new boreholes around the actual sub-county of Katine. 5 have been repaired, existing ones have been repaired. Springs have been protected and wells have been protected as well. So, and also there are new water and sanitation committees have been set up to ensure that they are sort of maintained on a regular basis. So that's a massive thing.
Now, as we go forward, you've still 2 more years to go. Mm. Are there any other big projects that you look forward to?
I think there'll be more work being done on the schools. Obviously, education is a key. It's obviously one of our key components, but also it's just a massive issue generally in Uganda and elsewhere in Africa. So there'll be more refurbishment work at the schools. There'll be a lot more work on from the livelihoods component, which is kind of difficult to see improvements right now after the first year.
How people make their livings.
Yes, basically. It's a very rural community, so farming, agriculture is a big thing. And so there's been the farm groups have been sort of established and have been planting new high yields of the basic crop of cassava. So it's kind of, we're going to see how that works out over the coming year, whether, you know, the first harvest, whether this has made a difference, whether the farming groups have been managed to galvanise people together to actually then sell produce in the markets, not just locally, but also further afield. So it's kind of how people are become more sustainable and be able to, you know, afford to buy things and sort of stand on their own 2 feet more, probably.
Now, talk to us about some of the difficulties that you've encountered, the Guardian or the project has encountered down there. A project of this complexity must have encountered some difficulties.
Yes, we have. I mean, we had a fair share of criticism when we first started it from various people. And one of the big issues is, you know, exit strategies. It's a short-term project, relatively short-term project. Lots of people aren't happy with area-based development. So that's going to become an interesting issue over the next 2 years because Farm Africa and AMREF are used to these kind of short-term projects. So, you know, how we work towards leaving a sustainable project behind will be an interesting point.
So is the argument that it's best to encourage a kind of central government to then give aid to the various counties and sub-counties?
Yeah, definitely. And through the project, AMREF, who've been in Africa for sort of 50 years and in Uganda for more than 20 years, work very closely with the district officers and the local government. The local government finds that the money that's coming from central government isn't actually getting to them. So they're very short on money as well. And they're probably quite critical about the national government. So there are wider issues. And a lot of people, do say you need to get the government right. But at the same time, that's a very long process.
Sure it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, and part of the problem is that we may, in developed countries, we may complain about how much local aid goes to various cities and towns, but in countries where there isn't a strong central government or where the strong central government may be corrupt, that's a much bigger problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And the problem with this particular region of Uganda, which is sort of in the northeast. They haven't been in the north. There's obviously been a lot of fighting with the Lord's Resistance Army, and that's kind of had its sort of a knock-on effect with the east. And they've had some incursions from the Lord's Resistance Army. They've also had cattle rustling, so they've had their fair share of problems that perhaps aren't as widely known. You know, a lot of people perhaps know about the north, but the east is kind of relatively been left to get on its own. So it has a lot of issues that need to be kind of addressed.
Liz Ford. If you want to find out more about the project, go to guardian.co.uk/Katine. That's K-A-T-I-N-E. That's all for this week. The podcast was produced by Ben Green. I'm Jim Falzerano. See you next time.